Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The internet, for all its benefits, can sometimes seem inescapable. If you have ever found yourself on vacation checking your email or monitoring your Facebook page, you know what I'm talking about. There are still places the internet has not reached, however, national parks, for example, but that could be changing. Earth Island Journal editor Jason Mark recently wrote about the topic for The Atlantic. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be here.
When we're talking about bringing the internet to national parks, the wilderness, what exactly do we mean? They can't literally mean everywhere, can it?
Well, it's going to start mostly with connectivity in the front country. Parks Canada, which is the National Park Service's counterpart up in north of the border, this summer began supplying Wi-Fi to the front country, so to the visitor centers and to the car campgrounds. And the U.S. National Park Service isn't far behind. And I think in some ways there's a lot of real benefits to that. And in my story, I talked with John Jarvis, who's the head of the National Park Service here in the U.S., and he made what I thought were some really good points about how having more connectivity, again, in places like, say, Yosemite Valley or the south rim of the Grand Canyon, that offers some ways to share the experience. But what's a little bit more ambitious than that is Google's plans for universal connectivity, for knitting all of the world into something of a giant Wi-Fi hotspot.
Is that even really possible?
Google seems to think it is, and I trust that on the technological end, they know what they're doing. They announced earlier this year that they're planning to spend between $1 billion and $3 billion in a couple of different schemes. One scheme would deploy a fleet of about 180 mini-satellites that will provide an internet signal from the sky. And then either as a complement to that or sort of as a substitute, may also involve high-altitude balloons or solar-powered drones that would supply high-speed broadband service. I don't think Google's intention there is to make sure you've got a signal if, let's say, you're in the far reaches of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. They're really thinking about connectivity for the billions of people in the world who still have not experienced the internet. But it will have that sort of knock-on effect of meaning that, yes, there'll be less opportunities to get away.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Jason Mark. He's the editor of Earth Island Journal, and he wrote a piece recently for The Atlantic regarding connectivity in the future, how it could become global. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right, Jason, it's easy for those of us who have the luxury at this point to get away versus people who live in remote areas, that's the circumstances of their life, and don't have that kind of connection.
Sure. I mean, and I think it goes, you know, it's almost, you know, the old saying of one man's trash is another person's treasure. I mean, at this point, I think many of us are feeling overburdened by the internet and by the constant connectivity. I know personally, and this is just anecdotal evidence, but I'm sure many listeners have felt this too, just sort of a increase in kind of what I would call white noise anxiety, right? It's just the extra little heart rate, pulse rate that you're kind of feeling all the time, with the constant checking of the emails or Twitter or Facebook or the news headlines. And I think one of the great virtues, right, of the summer getaway or, you know, any season of the year, the sort of getaway into wild places is the ability to disconnect. And that's been true for more than 100 years since John Muir celebrated wilderness as a refuge for a tired, nerve-shaken, over-civilized people. I mean, that kind of sounds quaint today, right? That was in the era before telephones and before the automobile had become...
Nerve-shaken, it's...
right, exactly. That was 100 years ago, 120 right. years ago. And yet, I think we feel more nerve-shaken today. And again, that chance to go either, you know, to a national park or to a wilderness area, one of our more than 700 wilderness areas in this country, that's a real chance to get away. And you know, someone could say, well, you can always turn off the phone and not look at it. And that's definitely true. But I think there's also the issue of what some have called connectivity creep, right? So let's say you're in some beautiful place and you spot a moose or a bear and you get a photo of it and you want to share it. I mean, then, you know, you share it and that's wonderful. But you're probably, if, you know, most of us, you might then pop on over to your email. Next thing you know, you've been sort of knocked out of the moment and out of that place and kind of sucked back into the world.
You wrote about a guy that you went on. Was it? Yeah, you went on a camping or backpacking trip with him in the Alaskan wilderness, right? And
yeah.
He talked about he'd never done that before, and he talked about, you know, how the mind sort of expands to fill those spaces when you don't have a device in hand.
Yeah, so I was earlier this summer in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge with an expedition arranged by the Sierra Club, and one of the people on the trip was a interesting composer, sort of artist in New York named DJ Spooky, a.k.a. Paul Miller. And Paul, yeah, he had a hard time disconnecting. He's a very wired guy. He's very plugged into the New York arts and music scene, and he's kind of always on the go. And I think for Paul, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, it was really tough disconnecting. And yet when he did, he came to find that he had a lot more imaginative space, creative space to sort of take a breather. And again, this has always been one of the functions of the getaway, whether that's to just a bucolic setting or to the deep wilderness. It's always been a resource for artists and writers and painters and composers to you know, this is at least for 200 years now, to get out of, you know, get out of the city, get out of civilization, and be able to sort of hit the reset button. And again, my concern with universal connectivity is that the opportunities for that will be diminished.
Someone that you talked to in, for the article compared it to, hey, would you want to go back in time and, you know, use basket backpacks and, you know, animal skins to, for your feet and so forth. And I didn't really get that because, I mean, all the backpacking gear that's been created over time, of which I've availed, to which I've availed myself, I don't see it that way at all. I don't think it's the same thing. But ultimately, it is a technology that I've enjoyed.
Sure. So that was
that's to help you get away, though.
Yes, well, that was my point, Anne. I mean, so National Park Service Director John Jarvis, when I interviewed him, made the point that, yes, we're not hiking with wicker baskets and wool sweaters. And I agree. I, as much as any REI member, I appreciate my space fabrics and my lightweight gear and my Gore-Tex, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
The difference, as you pointed out, and as I pointed out in my article, is that the one set of technologies enables us to go into wild places and, if not be exactly comfortable, at least, you know, it's at least an unbearable experience, right? There's still some inconvenience involved. The other one threatens to disrupt that experience. And again, that other meaning your cell phone or whatever sort of device you might have. And so, because just, and again, this is no real newsflash, just because of the way that technology sort of mediates our experience with the present and the visceral. It just kind of takes us a little bit out of the moment. And yeah, sometimes it allows us to share the moment. But again, my concern is that kind of connectivity creep. And so in the end, I think just as public lands conservation for more than 100 years in this country has relied on the idea that we need to restrain ourselves collectively, because we might not have the self-discipline, you know, individually not to chop down a tree. And the same way we should, I think, make a societal decision that some places should just be off the grid and outside the matrix, and that it's okay. In fact, it's a virtue to have some places where you can't connect and to give people that kind of mental breather.
And, you know, to what extent was it, did you talk about it in the story a little bit, but to what extent is it generational? You know, maybe 20 years from now, this is a moot topic. Everyone's going to say, are you crazy? Of course we want to be connected.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it is generational. I think the short answer is yes. And I think younger folks who are, you know, the National Park Service is worried that they're not seeing as many young people as they would like enjoying the parks. Though there's a pretty strong cohort of 25 to 34 year olds who do begin to kind of pick up outdoor recreation. And so the Park Service really believes that connectivity is a key to keeping the parks culturally relevant and socially relevant, and making sure that younger Americans are taking advantage of these resources that have been saved for us. So, yeah, I mean, I do think there's going to be different social norms, and that, again, what I sort of experience as a disturbance, other people might not.
Yeah, you wrote that universal connectivity would violate the spirit, if not the letter, of the law as established by the 1964 Wilderness Act.
Yeah, sorry, I'm in the helicopter just went over here. Yes.
Oh, that's what that is.
the Wilderness Act of 1964, which was signed 50 years ago next week by Lyndon Johnson, lays out a pretty clear legal definition of what a wild place is. And now there's 110 million acres in this country that have been preserved by the Wilderness Act. It was really, you know, one of the landmark accomplishments of the 20th century conservation movement. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear that a wilderness is defined as a place with ample opportunities for solitude. I think if you're able to check your email in the middle of Utah's Red Rock Desert, that opportunity for solitude is going to be compromised. And so, yeah, I think federal land managers are going to have to look a lot more seriously at this technology creep. And in fact, it's already happening. Last week, the National Park Service put out a new policy banning drones in the national park because they were having issues with people bringing drones in, which they felt was perhaps A, you know, could disturb other people's experience, or B, even, you know, be a public health danger, I guess, if one were to go astray and crash. So it's interesting, right, to hear national park officials now have to consider, well, what do we do about drones? And they're going to be looking at the issue.
And what interested me about the tidbit about the drones was they were filming people climbing, rock climbing. I mm-hmm. thought, who wants a drone sitting around? Unless they were planning it that way and they knew they were being filmed. But
right.
That would be kind of a
yeah,
drag.
I think some of this was filmmakers or adventure filmmakers. And again, the Park Service, my understanding is that the ban on drones is temporary until they come up with a permanent decision. So it's an interim solution, and they're erring on the side of caution right now. But I can certainly imagine that were I in the Yosemite backcountry and got buzzed by a drone, that, yes, I would break a little bit of the spell of being in a place where, again, human desires and human intentions don't dominate. And that's exactly why we have those places.
Okay. Well, Jason Mark, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Anna. It was fun.
Jason Mark, he's editor of Earth Island Journal. We'll have a link to his article in The Atlantic about connectivity in our wilderness areas of the world. If you have a question or Tech Tuesday continues when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's no secret that cell phone companies can track their customers' location. This technology has been used to solve crimes and track down the occasional missing person. But it turns out that this same technology is being sold to governments around the world. Here to talk about this, Craig Timberg. He's a technology reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly do these surveillance systems allow cell phone companies, and by way of cell phone companies, governments to do?
Well, the cell phone companies have to know where you are. If you're going to get a call or a text, they have to find you. So every carrier in the world keeps track of where its own customers are, and in particular what cell tower they're closest to. What these surveillance systems do is they send out, they basically reach into the carrier databases and grab this this location information, and they plot it on a map for a user. So if you're the government of Ethiopia and you want to find your Ethiopian political dissidents, if you have their phone number, you can find their location.
All right, so it's a location issue.
Yes.
To what extent is this happening now?
You know, it's hard to know exactly how often it's done because it's done very secretively. I had one person in the industry tell me that dozens of different governments around the world have bought these kinds of systems in the past few years. So, you know, if you're an ordinary person going back and forth to the grocery store, to the gym, and have no particular interest, I guess you don't need to worry very much. I think if you are a political activist or a human rights worker or, you know, in my case, a journalist, you may crave a higher degree of security about what your location is and who you're meeting with and where you're going. And if that's the case, you know, you really would hope that the carriers would do a better job of protecting this data they collect on you.
Better job? I mean, they must be profiting from it.
Not from these sorts of systems. I mean, it's not as though the carriers are selling this. This is data that is just really poorly protected, and the surveillance companies have figured out how to reach in and grab it and use it. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people who profit from location information. If you have a Starbucks app on your phone, right, and it helps you find your Starbucks, you know, the people who make those apps make money. Starbucks makes money by sending you coupons. So there's a huge industry of location-based services, but it's at least somewhat opt-in, right? You can turn that stuff off on your iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
You can't turn off the kind of tracking I wrote about in the paper yesterday. If you have a cell phone and you use the telecommunications network anywhere in the world, the people who use your systems can find you, and there's no real way to stop it.
Okay, so how long has this been going on? You're saying companies aren't necessarily selling this technology, they just aren't protecting it very well.
Well, so carriers aren't selling it, but there are makers of these surveillance systems, and I talk about a couple of different companies in the story that do sell the system. So the carriers collect the data. The surveillance systems are made by other companies, and they use computer queries to go and grab the data and plot it out on maps. So you sort of have two different actors in this.
I guess most people think there's just one actor. They think that their information is safe, but it's not.
Right. I mean, I spent a few months untangling this story, and let me tell you, there's a lot of actors in the telecommunications network. There's literally thousands of companies around the world that have access to these, what's called the SS7 network, which is the way that carriers talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So if I travel to Germany with my iPhone, in order to use that phone in Germany, the German carrier has to get in touch with my home carrier, Verizon, and say, you know, how do we get a call to Craig, right? So there's all of these almost instantaneous communications around the world of carriers. There's different companies that deliver text messages. There's analytics companies, thousands and thousands. And these companies make up a giant infrastructure. So you may think you're interacting just with Verizon or AT&T or Sprint, but you're really interacting with potentially, you know, hundreds of thousands of different companies, particularly if you roam around the world.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, Craig Timberg. He's a technology reporter for The Washington Post. And we're talking about how the information that cell phone carriers gather on our whereabouts is something that can be used by others. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. These systems are designed so that, or the companies that design them have made it so that neither cell phone users nor their carriers can detect the tracking, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they're reaching and grabbing this data, and those companies are then, you know, putting it on display for their customers. Now, that may be a police force somewhere. It could be, you know, a foreign intelligence service. I mean, one of the things that I think this story illuminates is that the kinds of technologies we learned about over the past year and the Edward Snowden disclosures, you know, variations of that are used kind of everywhere. Now the NSA is particularly powerful and effective, But let me tell you, there are dozens of countries around the world that can do all sorts of things in terms of finding out, you know, what sort of internet traffic you're looking at, what sort of emails you're sending and receiving, what your searches are, who you're talking to, what you're saying, and it's not just our government. It's a lot of other governments, and most of the rest of the governments in the world have even fewer protections than we do here.
Well, you know, I think about, okay, there's governments, but what about individuals?
It's a really good question. The security experts I talk to say that this technology is sufficiently, simple to use, that they believe that criminal gangs could get their hands on it. They believe that countries under sanction, like, you know, the North Koreans or the Iranians,
right,
could conceivably get access to it. In order to test the ability of this, we actually had a German telecommunications researcher try to track a colleague of mine here at the Washington Post. And this researcher was able to send a query through a network in Europe and grab my colleague's, you know, cell phone location here in Washington on her AT&T phone. So, you know, now he's obviously a specialized guy, but he's not, you know, he's not with an intelligence service. He's not a police officer. He just had access to the network and was able to send the right kind of query over the system and get the data.
Yeah, and there's nothing I can turn off to prevent this from happening.
You can throw your phone in the sea.
Okay.
Quit using it. You know, I need my phone, right? Like,
right.
I keep in touch with my wife and my kids. Like, I can't really live without it at this point. And the only real remedy to this would be more stringent defenses by the carriers, right? They could build, you know, the equivalent of firewalls, or they could screen queries in a more aggressive way. You could imagine a scenario in which the government would urge carriers in their countries to do more about this. In fact, in our country, the FCC, after I, you know, told them about this, said that they were going to look into this technology to see, you know, to the extent to which it's being abused. So it's possible that there'll be regulatory action, but in the end, you know, my experience in covering surveillance issues is that, you know, there tends to need to be a technological solution, at least as much as there needs to be a legal solution.
Yeah, how's the SEC going to know whether it's being abused anyways?
Well, they could, you know, they could subpoena people and gather information. They could, you know, I mean, I was able to find out a lot of information, and I don't have any, you know, I don't have subpoena power.
Okay.
I don't have force of law behind me. So they could investigate it, and they could, you know, require the carriers to do a better job of securing their data. That happens all the time in other industries, right? If Target or your bank loses your personal information, your social security number or your ATM card, like, they're in big trouble, right? The companies have a responsibility, a legal responsibility, to protect data. And the carriers, by and large, haven't really been held to that standard in the same way that some other industries have been.
So it's not necessarily legal, but it's not illegal.
Well, I guess that's sort of right. I mean, it would be illegal for me to track you, right? I'm here in the U.S., you're in the U.S., your phone is on a U.S. network. Like, that's against the law. You need a court order to do that.
Okay.
Or you need consent. And when we did the test here with my colleague, she gave written consent to do this test. But if it's, you know, if it's a foreign government or it's a spy of a foreign government here in Washington who wants to, you know, know where a congressman's going to, or who, you know, who the Secretary of State is meeting with, right? Like, that kind of capacity, you know, sort of exists in a world beyond laws. There's no world government in the end, right? There's no there's no entity that's going to tell, you know, the Russians to not listen into, you know, the commerce, you know, to track the movements of a U.S. executive who is in a competing business, right? I mean, there's no body that would oversee that. So the best defense is to make the systems much more resistant to surveillance than they are now. And my strong impression is that the telecommunication system is built to make surveillance pretty easy. And
yeah. How do they feel about it? Is this something that they don't want to have the responsibility to manage?
It's a good question. As you might imagine, the carriers weren't super keen to talk to me about this. The industry in general has, it's put a lot of energy into making sure that they can get calls to you and internet to you. And they put a lot of energy into making sure they can bill people properly, right? Like, those are the two prerogatives. And I guess the third prerogative is they need to comply with a bunch of laws that the U.S. government and other governments have imposed on them to allow for tracking people, to allow for listening in on your phone calls or intercepting your data. So the government has required the carriers build this capacity in.
Hmm.
And so, you know, protecting a user's privacy from other entities or even the abuse of sort of known entities, let's say a police officer wants to know, you know, where his ex-girlfriend's going, right? Like, that kind of personal security and privacy is not really built into our telecommunications system. It's not been an issue, which is one reason why the story to me was very important and startling a lot of people. You just don't realize what an amazing little spy device, you know, a smartphone is. There's been nothing like it in the history of the world.
I know.
They can listen to you. They can take your picture. They can run video, and you don't even know it, right? Someone has access to your phone, all your emails, all your documents, all your photos, and it can listen to you in real time. Like, what I wrote about doesn't do all those things, but there are technologies that do all of those things. And those technologies are sold on an open international market to governments all over the world and probably to other people as well.
So what are we talking about as far as cost goes here, and what does it look like? Tell us about, if I'm a government, you know, that wants to buy this, what am I buying and how do I use it?
I don't know what the cost is. I never came across a price list for this. In one of the documents I found, they charged more for more capacity, right? If you wanted to, you know, watch somebody in the country, in your own country, it was one price. If you wanted to watch somebody in like your two or three neighboring countries, it was another price. If you wanted to track anybody anywhere in the world, which is sort of the most powerful version of this technology, mm-hmm. it was still more. But I will tell you that other kinds of technologies, we do sometimes know the price where a price list was leaked the other day for a kind of software that does a similar sort of thing. If they can download something onto your phone, it can access all of your files, it can listen to you, and it can trick your phone into transmitting your location back to the people who are spying on you. And that system costs about $4 million for a government to install and use kind of as much as it wants to. So, you know, in this scheme of government budget, it's really not that much money. And it's mm-hmm. a lot less than hiring and keeping on payroll a bunch of spies to watch people. Like, that's expensive.
I wondered if, to a certain degree, that is, you do farm out some of the technology a little bit and just hire someone to do it for you on an ad hoc basis, if that's happening.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the companies I looked at, you could have them come into your office and install the whole system. But I think that they can also, you know, under contract more selectively track people on an ad hoc basis, as you say.
Do we know if anyone's been harmed because of this? In other words, somebody who's, you know, left a country because of persecution or political purposes and have been tracked down because of this and harmed?
So I don't have a kind of crystal clear case of this technology leading to a particular harm of a particular person, but there's lots of cases around of tracking technologies being used against journalists and human rights mm-hmm. workers and political activists in places like, you know, Bahrain and Morocco. It's even happened here in the United States. I did a story 6 months or so ago about what it appeared as though the Ethiopian government was tracking Ethiopian political opponents and journalists here in the Washington area. And they used a kind of software that gets installed on people's computers, and they were listening in on their Skype calls, and they were grabbing their documents and their pictures off of their computers. So it can be hard in any individual case to know what kind of technology is being used. And often these technologies are used together, right? So if you use the kind of technology I wrote about the other day, where you can find out sort of in general terms what cell phone tower someone's using. Let's say that a government realizes that, oh, I'm talking off of a cell phone that's in, you know, the northwest quadrant of D.C. in this sort of 10-block area. Then you can deploy other technology that's is more close up and granular to find out, oh, he's in that building on that floor, and this is and here's what he's talking about. So you have a broad-based network and then a more granular network. And those more granular systems, which are called IMSI catchers, those have been used an awful lot by law enforcement and everyone else. And there also are a lot of cases of criminals using them as well. So this stuff is out there. It's not that hard to get. It's not that hard to make. It's not super expensive, and there are not a lot of laws that govern their use. And the systems that we use every day are not particularly well hardened against surveillance of any sort.
We were sort of joking about before we went on the air that there's the ooh and the ah of technology, and then there's the you of technology, the creepy you.
Right.
So that's our dose for the day, I hope. Craig Timber, thanks for joining us. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Craig Timber, he's a reporter for The Washington Post. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. School supplies have changed over the years. What we used to lug around in our backpacks now fits in a smartphone. And what doesn't? Well, there's probably an app for that. Joining us now is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks.
So we asked for your recommendations for apps for students returning to class. One is an app called Silence, which in this case is golden if you can get it to work. Tell us about it.
So, you know, the most disruptive thing that can happen in a classroom right now in schools that allow smartphones for emergency use or, you know, whatever reason students are allowed to carry them is, a ringer not being silenced. And so the Silence app it allows you to set up scheduled silence periods where the phone automatically goes on silent, turns off all notification tones and all ringtones based on a schedule that you've input. So, you know, for school from, 8 o'clock in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the phone just doesn't make noise. I set it kind of the opposite so that it doesn't make noise while I'm sleeping, but that's kind of, I get too many emails, but you can set this to really any kind of schedule and it'll work exactly the way that you want it to. And in many cases there are, if you're not using this for school, there are also filters so that if you have, a family member or someone trying to get in touch with you while you have that schedule active, mm-hmm. Then they can still get through in emergency situations.
And you just enter in your schedule however you want it.
You can set it up exactly like you would an alarm clock, from 3 o'clock until 4 o'clock, I want the phone to be silenced every day, and it does it.
They'll never be the one whose phone rings during a lecture then. Another app you like is the Smart Voice Recorder. It seems like the idea is to record, people have been recording lectures, since the reel-to-reel. What makes this different?
Well, I had a regular tape recorder when I was recording lectures in college because the microphone on my phone wasn't good enough at the time, but microphones and smartphones are really, really good now. And so the Smart Audio Recorder, it will record just like, any other voice recorder. But what makes this one special is it will stop recording during periods of silence. So you can keep the app on and not have to touch the phone or anything. And the microphone will just turn off during silent periods. And then the file that you get at the end is just the talk, none of the stuff in between.
How about all the rustling around and people who are sitting near you kind of noise?
It really depends on exactly how sensitive the microphone in your smartphone is, but in most cases it can distinguish, voice from anything else and can set it to just that.
And the sound files, are they big enough to be useful?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, the sound files can be, in this case, you can move them to anything because it's already on your phone. You can even, if you have a cloud storage service that you prefer, like Dropbox or something like that, you can have it, upload just about immediately after it saves. It's really so much simpler than using tapes.
Okay. You also wanted to talk about one more app. It's called Cal. It's a calendar app. Tell us about it.
So every smartphone has a calendar application built into it, but not all of them are particularly good. The ones in Android, unless you're using the one that's made by Google, you know, it kind of doesn't sync very well across multiple devices. And you can run into some problems if you have multiple people's schedules that you want to keep track of.
Mm-hmm.
I use Cal. It's just C-A-L, made by a company who originally had a to-do list as like their primary app.
Oh, okay.
And they switched to this really cool format. It's you know, visually very pretty and allows me to sync my calendar with multiple other people so that, you know, I see in line what everyone else in my particular group is doing. And it makes, especially in a household with three kids, it makes managing that kind of thing super easy. So I would definitely recommend that for students who have multiple people that they need to keep track of, even in just group projects. You know, that kind of thing can be really useful.
What does it look like on your phone? Is it up on the screen as soon as you open it up? As soon as you turn it on, I
sure.
should say?
Yeah, I mean, so basically you can set it to view either, you know, month, day, or week, and you can designate specific colors for specific people or different kinds of events. It will sync with Facebook, so if you have Facebook events that want to come in, then those can populate as well. And it's just a very clean, very pretty-looking calendar that has every feature that I could have possibly asked for.
Okay, so we've got Cal, the smart voice recorder, and Silence, the three golden apps for a successful school year. Covering all the bases. You wanted to talk about thermal imaging. This is it called Flyer?
FLIR, yeah.
FLIR. They got to start having pronunciations with these things. Anyways, it's a new iPhone case that has some people excited. The FLIR, it's for thermal imaging?
So FLIR is one of the biggest names in thermal imaging, but their thermal imaging sensors, because they are some of the best, are incredibly expensive. And what you're basically, you know, I mean, it's something that you – I don't think I know anybody who wouldn't want to play with a thermal imaging camera at least once.
Okay.
But it's certainly not something that you would, you know, spend $1,000 on to just mess around with. So this is actually an iPhone case that has all of FLIR's imaging – sensors built into the back of the case, and then works with an app on the phone to basically turn your iPhone into a thermal imager. And it's so cool because it takes, you know, the basic thermal imaging idea where you can, you know, grab the temperature and you can see the color map for the temperatures, but you can also use the iPhone's camera to record, you know, anything that you wanted to grab, you know, thermal visuals of, and it's really impressive to see how well it works.
What is it in the it's a cover for your phone?
Yes, yeah, it's a case. You know, it would basically replace whatever your current iPhone case is.
My OtterBox or whatever it might be.
Right. And
okay.
It even kind of looks a little similar to an OtterBox because
okay.
It's kind of it's a little on the blocky side and it sits on the outside. But yeah, it adds, you know, thermal imaging tools to your iPhone. So it's one of those things where, you know, you'd have to really be into it, but, you know, if you are, this is probably the coolest iPhone accessory I've ever seen.
And it's something you'd carry with you all the time.
You certainly could. Yeah, you could use this as the case for your phone. I mean, you know would obviously risk you know, damaging it if you were to drop it on something serious, but that, you know, you probably would be damaging your phone as well.
Well, I never dropped my phone. That's why I got an OtterBox. So I don't have to worry about it.
Maybe
but
we need an OtterBox to go around the thermal imaging case as well.
There you go.
We need another layer of protection. But no, I mean, it's a very durable feel. It doesn't feel like it's going to break if you go and drop it. Obviously, I haven't thrown it out in the street yet or anything. But, you know, so far it's been a really cool experience.
And the cost.
They are $349, so certainly a great deal more expensive than an OtterBox, but way less expensive than a regular thermal imaging camera.
And does it only work with iPhone?
It does currently only work with iPhones because it has to, you know, making that case and making it so that it fits into, you know, that specific size is kind of hard to do. So it works with the iPhone 5 and the iPhone 5S, and presumably there will be an iPhone 6 version shortly after the iPhone 6 is launched.
Does it suck up power from the phone?
You know, my boss has one, and he's been using it for a while, and he said that, you know, he used it for ton the first day and a bunch afterwards, and didn't really notice that it was any more battery intensive than he would if he was just walking around with his camera open messing around.
Is this the guy that photographed the coffee pot maker?
Yes.
Cooney found something more interesting than that is all I have to say. But
well, I mean, when you want to see, you know, flowing heat in an office environment, I mean, that was a good way of showing that, I think.
I suppose you could bring it to, you know, the Starbucks or whatever and make sure your coffee's hot in the morning. So, right? It sounds interesting. It sounds like one of those, if you have the money, crazy gifts you can get somebody. Something fun.
Oh, absolutely.
Crazy fun. There is also, by the way, listeners, if you have a question or comment for Russell Holley on anything to do with technology, you can give us a call. We haven't been able to stump Russell in a long time. It would be fun to do that today. We have a little extra time. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Please don't wait to make those calls if you have a question. Hey, if you have a question about what kind of computer to send to school with your kid or any kind of education-related tech question, Russell's pretty good about that. He's been answering my questions privately for 2 weeks now. Okay, so there's a new phone from HTC and Verizon. For those of us who among us prefers a smaller screen, tell us about the HTC One Remix.
So the HTC One Remix is part of a line that HTC refers to as the mini version of their phones, because, you know, we've seen this really weird trend over the last year or so where, you know, smartphones are just getting bigger. You know, smartphones that aren't the iPhone, I guess. Mm-hmm. The screens are getting larger and they're getting beautiful. I mean, they look really, really great when you go to do stuff, but sometimes some of these phones are really not easy to use with a single hand anymore. And the HTC One Remix is, you know, kind of a shift back down. It is but it's still, you know, kind of on the bigger side. It's a 4.5-inch 720p display that looks, you know, really good. It's not, it doesn't look quite as nice as the original HTC One M8 that it is based on, but you get the same front-facing speakers and a lot of the same features, but not all of the same features as its larger brother.
Where are people putting their phones now? Do I kind of carry mine around?
You know, I can't say that I spend a whole lot of time watching people pull phones out of their pockets anymore, but I don't imagine that, that, you know, we're seeing larger pockets to put them in. So they have to be going somewhere.
Do you wear yours on your belt?
No. Mine usually go in my pocket or in my bag. Unfortunately, I usually have more than one, so yeah. I have like a backpack that I put them in.
How many do you carry?
I'm not comfortable answering that question.
Okay. Really? Okay. You really are a geek.
I'm packing light when I carry two. I'll put it that way.
Okay. That's okay, Russell. That's okay. So it's a smaller version of the popular HTC One smartphone. Are there any downsides? Is it just smaller, or are you letting go of something too?
You're letting go of a little bit. HTC for the One M8 had a really cool camera in the back that had a lot of special effects, like you know, the ability to control your depth of field and things like that. What they called their duo camera, and that is missing from the back of this. Instead, you get a 13 megapixel just kind of regular camera with a 5-megapixel camera on the front. They both take decent pictures, but it's, mm-hmm. when you compare the two side by side, it's not quite as good as what the HTC One M8 was doing. And you also lose the ability to control things like your television because the IR sensors on the top of the phone are no longer there. But just about everything else is there.
Okay. And price?
They are $50 on a new 2-year agreement with Verizon, which
wow.
is certainly a lot cheaper than the $200 that you would pay for the HTC One M8. The battery life on this, I've been using it for a couple of weeks now. The battery life has been really good. The phone is a lot of fun to use. It still has the big speakers on the front of the phone that are so loud. They definitely do a very good job. If you want a smaller phone and you don't want to, you know, kind of pay that $200 premium that
yeah.
a lot of the newer phones go for, this is definitely an option.
We talked, I think it was last week, about Twitch, which
yes.
is the company that what Twitch does is let you watch other people play games on live, or you can go back and look at an archive of them, right?
Yes.
Okay, we talked about that because Google was thinking about buying it. And one thing I'm not sure we got to is what the impact would be if it was bought by one of these gigantic tech companies. But now Amazon has bought it, $970 million?
Yep. It's funny that we look at some of these acquisitions in terms of some of their previous acquisitions. An interesting way of looking at this is that Twitch was bought by Amazon for just slightly less than Facebook bought Instagram.
Okay.
And it is still just a huge amount of money, but it's a good thing for both of these companies. Twitch, as a company, has been self-sufficient. They kind of run all of their own stuff, and as a result, sometimes they just get overwhelmed by the sheer volume of users.
Mm-hmm.
And paying for that kind of infrastructure is expensive. Amazon has given them a huge cash infusion to deal with that, on top of the fact that Amazon's existing, kind of back-end server stuff is really, really powerful. It's the same stuff that Netflix uses to make sure that everyone's videos stream really well. And this is also the first company that Amazon has directly done business with that supports, is all about user-generated content. You think about Amazon is always kind of the retailer that sells things to you. And so now Amazon owns a company. This will be the first Amazon service that is all about, user-generated content. So it's going to be really interesting to see how the two of them grow. But apparently, one of the big, staples in this agreement is a bit of autonomy. So it's unlikely that we'll see, Twitch get rebranded into anything anytime soon or anything like that.
But you'll see lots of Amazon ads.
Well, yeah, I imagine that Amazon's advertising platform will get worked into that eventually. A lot of times those kind of ad deals, I know especially the ones that the Twitch has, they go for a pretty significant period of time. But I imagine that, we will see some Amazon feature integration, including, some sort of advertisement and maybe even, working into their retail service, where you gain some kind of Twitch exclusive feature, for buying a game from Amazon.
Any advantage one way or the other to the folks who use Twitch that Amazon got it instead of Google?
Well, there's a lot of speculation one way or the other as far as how that would have worked. The biggest benefit here from Amazon, from the Amazon perspective that Google maybe wouldn't have been able to offer is that autonomy, because with YouTube, a lot of the YouTube features and the way that YouTube handles business probably would have been incorporated into Twitch. Google has a pretty long-standing history of that kind of behavior, whereas Amazon doesn't really have, directly competing services that can be kind of integrated or merged. But I do think that we'll see, things like Amazon's Fire TV, gaining Twitch streaming support and things like that.
And the autonomy issue, it does make you wonder sometimes when they buy up these companies, there's a certain amount of autonomy seems to play in a lot of these deals because they want these innovators and these people who came up with it in the first place to keep doing it, keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, the letter that Jeff Bezos wrote announcing the merger was all about, giving Twitch the financial support to, kind of move faster in this space. And a lot of that has to do with, just the volume of competition that has come up around Twitch since the company became popular.
Mm-hmm.
So, when the last year has really been, the guys behind Twitch kind of bailing water out of a sinking ship. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be something they're not going to have to worry about.
Okay, Russell Holley, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's a tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks to the Allside staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannan, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is Allsides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.